This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Showdown at Centerpoint, Volume 3 of the Corellian Trilogy by Roger McBride Allen.
Solo, we are running out of time. We will be entering atmosphere soonest if our approach is not controlled.
Either the comm circuit up to the ship's control cabin was on the verge of giving out again, or else Han had just gotten lucky and Drachmas was about to lose her voice. Han slapped the answer switch and tried to stay focused on his work. Keep your shirt on, Drachmas. Tell honored pilot Zelkul that I'm nearly done.
What shirt? Should shirts be worn? Is this for safety?
Han sighed and pushed the answer button again. It's an expression. It means be patient. Drachmas was a Solonian, and most Solonians did not like being in space. Understandable for a species that mostly lived underground, but having an agoraphobic who wasn't even a pilot in command of a rundown cone ship was enough to drive anyone crazy. Han Solo engaged the power switch, waited for the inverter system to energize, and crossed his fingers. He was starting to question his sanity in volunteering to help fly this particular cone ship down out of free space to the surface of Solonia. He could have said, so long and good luck, and ridden down with Leia on the Jade's Fire. But when a job needed doing and no one else could do it, volunteering was not really all that voluntary. He had obligations to Drachmas and to her people. And Drachmas had made it clear that her people, the Solonians, or more accurately, the Hunchuzuk Den, couldn't afford to abandon any spacecraft, no matter what shape it was in. Knowing he was with the Hunchuzuk would have been a bit more useful if Han had had some clear idea about who or what the Hunchuzuk Den was. All he knew for sure was that the Den was part of an amorphous faction of Solonians who had left their planet in the Corellian system to live on his own home planet of Corellia. And that so far as Drachmas knew, they were still allied to a pro-New Republic alliance of Solonian dens called the Republicists. Drachmas had either kidnapped Han or rescued him from Thrakken Sal Solo, Han's cousin and the leader of the thugs who called themselves the Human League. Or both, Han was still not sure. The Hunchuzuk seemed to be having a fight with the Overden, the leadership on Solonia proper, a fight that was going on in parallel with the New Republic's battle against the rebellions in the Corellian system, though the two did not seem to be directly related to each other. The Overden wanted absolute independence for Solonia. Han was coming to the conclusion that each side was primarily against the other. But Drachmas had saved his life, and she had taken risks to treat him well. Han knew that Thrakken Sal Solo had treated Drachmas' people with the utmost cruelty. Since relatives in Solonian society were genetically identical, Solonians were likely to assume that Han was a villain like his cousin, yet Drachmas had given him every benefit of the doubt.
When will it be working? The planet is getting closer.
Don't hold me to this, but I think the spare parts off Mara's ship did the trick. We ought to be able to get underway anytime you like. The indicators flickered to show the inverters were drawing more power. Take it easy up there. Throttle up nice and slow, all right?
We are doing so, Honored Solo. We have no desire to overload our systems again.
Han climbed up to the nose cabin of the cone ship. The cone ship was just that, a fat cone with the engines at the base and the control cabin in the point. The nose itself was nearly all transplex, affording a spectacular overhead view. The Solonia pilot, Zelkul, lay flat on her back, looking up and out at the sky ahead. She gave Han a toothy smile and returned her attention to her work, but the large, otter-like creature looked anything but calm. How does all go? Han asked Zelkul, speaking in his rather labored Solonian. Zelkul did not speak Basic.
All is well, Honored Solo. At least until the next subsystem flips out.
Wonderful, Han muttered. Sal Kuhl was a fairly experienced pilot and knew her ship reasonably well, if not as well as Han would have preferred. Drachmas, on the other hand, was trained to deal with humans. When it came to ship handling, she had no experience and no skill. Even so, she commanded the ship, not just in deciding where it would go, but down to the detail of every maneuver. Sal Kuhl could not or would not overrule her. Drachmas was of higher status, and that was that. Neither seemed much concerned by the fact that Drachmas had only a slight understanding of space operations, or that during the battle between the New Republic and their allies against units from the various rebellions, she had repeatedly ordered the ship to do things it could not do, and had come alarmingly close to getting them all killed. The view out the transparent nose of the cone ship was nothing less than spectacular. The Salonian landmass was broken up into thousands of medium-sized islands, more or less evenly spaced across the face of the planet. But there was more to the view than the planet. Mara Jade's personal ship, the Jade's Fire, hung in space a kilometer or two away, her bow hiding a bit of the planet's equatorial region. Mara's ship was long and streamlined, painted in a flame pattern of red and gold. The ship looked fast, sleek, strong, maneuverable, and Han knew she was all of those things. After Drachmas had given Sal Kuhl orders that had blown out nearly every system on board the cone ship, the fire had rescued them and provided Han with the spare parts he needed to repair the craft. Now the fire was preparing to see the cone ship to a safe landing. A bright light flashed on and off from the forward port of the fire. Leia was using the landing lights on the Jade's Fire to send Mon Calamari blink code, combinations of long and short flashes to form the letters of the basic alphabet. "Ready to begin entry," Han read. "Signal when ready. Ana Drachmas, take your seat and prepare for acceleration. Sal Kuhl, you will fly a standard approach to the intended field of landing, starting on my command. Is that understood?"
"Yes, indeed, absolutely."
As Han watched, the Jade's Fire came about on her long axis, putting her stern toward the cone ship. Sal Kuhl edged the throttle upward, transferring minimum power to the engines. As the cone ship began to accelerate toward the planet, the fire drifted back. As the more maneuverable ship, it made sense for the fire to go in second, where she could keep watch on the cone ship. But the cone ship was all but completely blind astern. All she had was one wide-angle camera set in the base of the cone between two of the sublight engines. It would be useful during the final approach and landing, but even with the main engines off, its resolution was so poor that the Jade's Fire would be lost to view if she drifted only a few kilometers away. The poor visibility made for another good reason to have the fire go in second. Better to have a ship you trusted at your back. At least a ship you more or less trusted. Han had managed to put to rest most of his reservations regarding Mara. He could think of no reason, no motive for her acting against Han and Leia and the Republic, despite her past as the Emperor's hand. But in recent days, she had been in the right places at the right times, and the wrong places at the wrong times, a bit too often. On the other hand, if she had wanted to do real damage, Mara was too much of a pro to let things be bungled. Say whatever else you might about the woman, Mara was competent. The planet moved closer. In another few minutes, Sal Kuhl would have to turn the ship over and point its engines forward to slow the craft. That was the part that worried Han. Once they were decelerating, they would be at their most vulnerable. The cone ship's fragility was far from the only source of danger. Someone on Salonia had sent a whole fleet of light attack fighters up to attack the Bakuran ships that were assisting the New Republic on this mission. The Bakurans had done a fair amount of damage to the LAFs, but Han had to assume that whoever commanded them would have the sense to hold some in reserve. To make matters worse, the cone ship was completely unarmed and had no shields at all. Leia Organa Solo, Chief of State of the New Republic, sat at the navigator's station aboard the Jade's Fire, watching the cone ship drift in toward Salonia. What exactly was Han getting them into? Leia was forced to think not just like a wife, but like a politician. There was no question that Han was being drawn in by these Salonians, and that she was being drawn in as well. It would be all too easy for the New Republic to find itself involved in one side or the other of the fight.
"He'll be all right, Leia," Mara said. "We'll stay right with them all the way down."
"Hmm? What? Oh, yes," Leia said. It was mortifying to be reassured by Mara Jade, of all people. Mara frowned and adjusted the thrust controls.
That Solonian pilot needs a flying lesson or two. She's doing the pitchover maneuver way too early, and without shutting off her engines, nearly clipped her.
Mara was forced to fly evasive patterns just to keep the fire from crashing into the other ship. Suddenly, she noticed something on her detector displays.
Leia, weapons and shields to standby, fast. A bunch of blips just showed up out of nowhere.
Leia watched as the defense trackers came on.
More light attack fighters. 12 in all, coming in right over our stern.
Mara shook her head as she stared down at the navigation display.
We can handle them, but it won't be easy, not with the cone ship to cover.
We're too far off to extend our shields toward the cone ship.
And we're gonna stay that way. I'm not getting any closer to that pilot than I have to. Stand by for combat maneuvers.
Wait! We have to blink code to Han, warn them.
You've got 25 seconds.
Han was almost too busy trying to keep from being flung out of his chair to notice the flashing lights in the overhead viewport. The trouble was that he was only marginally better at reading blink code than he was at sending it. B-A-N-D-I... something... something Bandai... Bandits! Oh, great.
Bandits. Enemy fighters were headed this way. Han glanced over at the Solonians. There was no point in telling Sal Kuld about the bandits until she had the ship under control.
Now then, Sal Kuld, one other matter. Is time to, test our defense plan. You will bring the ship to spin, please, of 3 spins per minute?
Yes, yes, commencing axial spin.
The ship began to rotate around its conical axis, so the stars pinwheeled across the sky. Han could barely spot the fire, and the bandits were almost certainly smaller coming from behind. There was no way he could find them, especially with the ship spinning like a top. No point worrying about things he could not change.
Disable inertial damping, he said casually.
The inertial dampers prevented anything more than a few percent of a ship's acceleration from being felt by those aboard. Without them, the occupants of a ship accelerating to light speed could be squashed to jelly.
But if we cannot restart inertial damping...
Sal Kuld began.
Worry about such later.
Han knew better than Sal Kuld what it might mean if they couldn't get the dampers back on, but they would have to live long enough for the problem to come up. Sal Kuld inhaled nervously and cut off the inertial damping system. All of a sudden, Han felt his weight double, then triple.
Confirm all inner airlock sealed.
All inner airlock doors sealed.
Han struggled to concentrate on the spinning star field overhead. If this was going to work, it would take exact timing. But how could he time anything if he couldn't see?
Leia worked the shield settings on the Jade's fire. Shields configured as ordered, she said.
Good, Mara replied.
Maintain turbolasers at standby. We are going to act like they aren't there. They might decide we can't see them.
What good does that do us?
They might blow right past us and zero in on the cone ship. My guess is that whoever's on those LAFs is targeting the Hunchuzuk, not us.
But Han is...
Safer this way, Mara kept watching her displays. If the LAFs don't engage us, we'll have nice, clear forward view shots right up their stern plates while they're focused on the cone ship.
Leia gave in again. Mara had far more experience in this sort of fight than she did.
Stand by. Here they come, Mara said.
Leia watched the stern detector displays as the LAFs came in directly behind the fire's stern, trying to hide in the detection shadows produced by the sublight engines. They were trying to sneak up. From that bearing, they wouldn't even show up on most ships' detectors. The LAFs flashed past the fire, zeroing in on the cone ship.
Here they come!
Han shouted in basic, forgetting for a moment to speak in Solonian. Sal Kuld got the message all the same. She looked up through the viewport at the tiny spots of light in the sky and understood precisely what was going on.
Calmness! Throttle down all engines. Stand by to open outer airlock doors.
The lead LAF fired, and the bolt slammed into the hull like a giant fist.
It's all right!
Han shouted, having not the least idea if it was or not.
Stand by on airlock doors. Be ready.
The Jade's fire's forward quad turbo laser blazed away, tracking the LAF across the sky. The LAF broke off its attack run, trying to escape, but the Jade's fire regained a positive lock and poured on the turbo lasers. The fighter exploded in a blossom of flame. The rest of the LAFs were not going to be such easy pickings. They had their rear shields powered up to maximum and did a better job of evasive maneuvers. But it wasn't good enough to fool Leia.
She settled in with the manual controls and concentrated her fire on the LAFs closest to the cone ship. She got a lock on one and blew it to bits. Just then, the cone ship cut its engines, allowing it to drop straight for the planet's surface. It threw the LAFs off, if only for a moment or two. Leia sighed. Not much of an evasive maneuver, but probably the best Han could manage with that clunky piece of junk. But suddenly, her detector display showed a cloud of debris blooming out from the cone ship in all directions. Fear stabbed at her heart. That one hit on the hull couldn't have done that much damage, could it? But then something happened to one of the LAFs, and then another, and another. As they swooped in close to the cone ship, they bounced and skittered and wobbled off course. Two of them lost power, and the third was rocked by a small explosion amidships. Leia tried to track to a new target, but the LAFs had plainly decided to accept the fact they weren't welcome. They scattered, hightailing out of there in all directions. Suddenly Leia understood. Mara! New course, 5 or 6 kilometers to one side of Han, and try to overtake him. It's not going to be safe to be behind him for a while. Leia smiled, relief flooding over her. She should have known Han wouldn't give up without a fight. Han listened closely as the last of the junk went lumbering out of the airlocks, banging and clattering. He had spent half a day policing the ship, looking for every bit of surplus or broken hardware he could find. Buckets of bolts, worn-out spare parts, garbage from the galley. He had thrown all of it into the locks. And all of it had tumbled out into space when the locks were opened, thrown clear by centrifugal force. Result, a cloud of slow-moving space junk right in the path of the attacking LAFs. Plowing through pieces of broken metal at a speed of something like 1,000 kilometers an hour was very far from a good idea. However, piling a ship into a planet was an even worse one. Salkult, re-establish inertial dampers and cut ship spin. The ship's ungainly spin slowed, then stopped, and then started up again in the opposite direction and started to get faster. Salkult, this is no time for the playing of games. Hunter Solo...
Failure in lateral attitude control system. I cannot shut it off.
Oh, for... Han scrambled up out of his seat and dove for the main circuit breaker box. He yanked it open and tripped the lateral attitude control breaker by hand. That killed the thrusters that were producing the spin, but also killed the ones that fired in the opposite direction and could bring it to a halt. He slapped the access door shut and returned to his seat.
Hope everyone is liking to spin for a while.
Salkult, restart to main sublight engines, and nice, slow throttle up, please. Nothing seemed to happen.
Not that slow, Salkult. We need to do some braking.
Salkult looked at Han, panicked.
Engine initiator, not responding. Horror,
cried Drachmus.
We incinerate for certain.
Once again, Han rushed for the ladder and clambered down to the lower decks as fast as he could. Without the sublight engines, the cone ship was going to drop like a stone. They had to restart those engines.
Out! Han shouted at Salkult as he came up out of the hatch. Out of pilot chair, now! I take over.
But what are you...
I've taken the disperser out of the loop and run the cables through the initiator power intake on the engine power system. The feedback energy is accumulating in the repulsor system. When the power level is high enough, I'll reset the feedback power breaker and dump the energy right into the initiator intake on the engine power systems.
What?
Jumpstart it! I'm gonna jumpstart it!
There was a moment of dead silence in the control cabin before Drachmus let out a strangled moan and covered her face with her hands. For a fleeting moment, Han thought of Leia, watching from the Jade's fire and unable to do anything. He thought of his 3 children off somewhere in the care of Chewbacca and the children's drow tutor, Ibrahim. No, he could not die. They needed him. Han waited as long as he dared, then one moment longer, then one more, and then... He slammed down the relay reset switch as hard as he could and felt a horrifying lurch just as a low, rumbling explosion shook the ship. That would be the repulsors blowing. For a long, sickening moment, nothing else happened. But then the engine's initiated indicator came on and Han had 3 good engines. Even if that was 1 less than he had hoped for, it was 3 more than he'd expected. Ignoring all his own advice, he brought the throttle up fast. There wasn't time to nurse the engines. The cone ship slowly pitched back
until it was flying at about a 45-degree angle of attack. It was still falling straight down, but now its nose was pointed an eighth of a turn away from the vertical. If Han had it figured right, that ought to give the cone ship a bit of aerodynamic lift, causing it to work like an airfoil. The ship began to move sideways, as well as down. It began to bang and shudder violently, but every crash and rattle was that much more excess energy expended.
Agan Solo,
Drachmas protested above the racket.
Where are you taking us?
I haven't the faintest idea, but we have to go lateral to shed some speed.
But suppose we land outside the zone controlled by my den?
Then we have a problem.
Drachmas did not reply to that, but she had a point. Landing completely at random on a planet in the midst of civil war was not exactly prudent. Han pushed it from his mind. The job of the moment was getting this thing down in one piece, down where they could sort out later. He checked his gauges. They were still falling like a rock, but a slower rock, a gliding rock. And hull temperatures were actually falling. Maybe they were going to make it. Han cut power to all systems and diverted it all into the inertial dampers. There was no way the dampers could absorb all the energy of impact, but they would soak up some of it. He had not the faintest idea where they were about to land. 1 kilometer up, 800 meters. How accurate was that altimeter anyway? 200, 150, zero. Negative 10 meters, well, not all that accurate. But every extra meter was another fraction of a second for the cone ship's engines to slow them down. Neg 20, neg 50.
The overhead viewport held together, somehow. And Han could see the sky was filled with smoke and steam and mud. Huge gobs of sodden dirt splattered down on the viewport, covering it all but completely. Except for Drachmas moaning in fright and the plopping sounds of mud raining down on the ship's hull, all was quiet. They were down and alive. The cone ship had buried itself into the soft mud of a pond. Han sat on the edge of the hatch and hopped down, only to sink in over his ankles in the thick mud. He lifted his left foot up out of the muck, nearly losing a boot in the process, and planted it as far away from the ship as possible before pulling his right foot out. He squelched out of the pond basin toward dry land and saw a Solonian, an older-looking female with graying dark brown fur and a moody look in her eye.
"That's a hunch as a cone ship, be it not?"
the Solonian asked, watching Drachmas and Salkult stagger out of the craft.
"That's right," Han said as he slogged through the mud.
"That was the Solonians for you. A spaceship crash lands in a pond in front of someone, and what's the response? Not shock, or surprise, or fear. Not hello, or what an amazing escape. Not are you all right? No. The first thing to worry about was what den was involved."
"Humph," said the Solonian. "This is Chanzari land. We be republicists, Hunchuzuk allies."
The Bakurin light cruiser Intruder fired her main forward turbo laser battery 3 times, and 3 pocket patrol boats exploded.
"Very well,"
said Admiral Hortel Osinage.
"You may hold your fire. Bring the turbo lasers to their stowed position and power them down. Make sure our friends can detect what you're doing. We have shown we can hurt them at will. Now we extend an invitation to leave."
Luke Skywalker stood next to Admiral Osinage on the bridge of the Intruder. A reasonable tactic, Luke thought. As always, when he agreed with the man, he did not feel comfortable doing so. He glanced at Lando Calrissian standing on the other side of Osselage, and the look on his face told him that Lando shared his concerns. The tactics were sound, even conservative. The enemy forces consisted of little more than 20 or so pocket patrol boats. There was nothing much to be gained in wiping out such a small force. Very sensible and cautious. Except that Osselage was not a cautious commander. If it seemed he was trying something careful, Luke had a hunch that it was merely a cover for something madly audacious to follow. Or had losing the one of his 4 cruisers, the Watchkeeper, to the Solonian planetary repulsor cost Osselage his nerve? Of course, with the overwhelming bulk of Centerpoint Station dominating the sky outside the viewports, Luke would have felt a little edgy even if the Watchkeeper hadn't been destroyed.
There they go,
Lando announced, pointing toward a cloud of tiny dots lifting away from one of the docking bays of Centerpoint. The defending fighters were withdrawing.
Decided they couldn't do any good against us, I guess. Or perhaps they decided we would be unable to do Centerpoint any harm, said Ocelage.
A service droid wheeled up from behind them and stopped in front of Lando.
Begging your pardon, sir, but Lieutenant Kalinda wishes to see both you and Master Skywalker, sir. A new message from Source T has come in.
Source T was Tendra Rezaant. Lando and Luke had met Tendra on Sikoria, one of the so-called outlier worlds of the Corellian sector. The local authorities had kicked Lando and Luke off Sikoria shortly after they arrived. Lando had met Tendra while searching the galaxy for a rich wife. From what Lando could piece together, she had spotted some sort of military buildup in the Sikorian system. Recently, a powerful jamming system had cut off virtually all communications in the Corellian sector. Then an interdiction field had gone up, preventing travel through hyperspace anywhere in the sector. Believing these events related to the buildup, Tendra had decided to get word to Lando. She had gotten her hands on an old spaceship, bribed her way off Sikoria, and crashed into the interdiction field. Even though she couldn't get to Lando in person, he had made it possible for her to contact him. The signals from the radionics communications set he had given her were immune to jamming and undetectable to anyone using standard comlink equipment. It took long hours for her messages to reach him, but it could take long, weary months before her ship could cross the same distance. Unless, of course, they could bring down the interdiction field, and that was why they were heading toward Centerpoint Station, where the jamming seemed to originate. The security system beeped its clearance code, and the hatch to the comm section slid open. Lieutenant Belindi Kalenda of New Republic Intelligence was waiting for them. An odd-looking young woman. Right now, her wide-spaced, slightly off-kilter eyes did not look happy.
"Didn't anyone ever tell your lady friend how to count?" she said. "We still have no idea how many ships are waiting out there at Sikoria."
"We wouldn't have known there were any ships at all there if not for Lady Tendra," Lando said sharply.
"Let's try and get back on track here," Luke said. "What's wrong with Lady Tendra's message?"
"We have sent 3 queries asking her to give further details of the type, sizes, and numbers of ships she saw. Her latest message seems more precise, but once you weed out all the qualifiers, we still have nothing but the vaguest estimates."
"Well, she can't tell you what she doesn't know," Lando said.
"There are also limits to how many messages you can ask her to send," Luke put in. "Every time she sends us one, the odds of her being detected go up." Kalinda looked at Luke sharply.
"Detected? How?"
"Think about it," Lando said. "You're the intelligence officer. The way she's broadcasting is secret, but it's in clear without any coding or encryption. Anyone who has the right sort of gear for scanning radio band frequencies could lock in on her radionics transmission in a heartbeat."
Kalinda nodded reluctantly.
"Let's leave it there," Lando said. "We're coming up on Centerpoint Station. Figuring that out ought to be enough to keep us busy."
The Lady Luck launched out of the intruder's landing bay and lifted off into the blackness of the sky toward Centerpoint. Lieutenant Kalenda and Bakurin ex-Prime Minister Gariel Capitason rode with Lando, as did C-3PO.
"Why do I always get handed these jobs?"
Lando asked no one in particular. "Maybe it has something to do with the way you volunteered," replied Gariel Capitason from the seat behind the co-pilot station.
"I had to volunteer. Once Luke volunteered, I knew he was going to need his wingman."
"Actually, Lady Capitason," said Kalinda, "you're the one I most wish weren't here."
"Thanks for that compliment," Lando muttered.
Kalinda winced. "Sorry, that came out wrong. What I meant was that Captain Calrissian and Master Skywalker have military training. They're more likely to be ready for whatever we find. Not really the job for an ex-Prime Minister." "There might be someone reasonable with whom we can negotiate on Centerpoint Station. If so, having a trained negotiator such as myself on hand might be a good thing," said Gariel.
"We're gonna have to get really lucky for that to happen," Lando said. "So far, we haven't found many people who are particularly reasonable in this star system."
Luke Skywalker felt good. He was back at the controls of his X-Wing, alone, except for R2-D2 up in his socket. He looked toward the massive station and could scarcely believe his eyes.
He had seen the reports, he had read the numbers, but somehow numbers did not express the size of the object hanging in the sky.
Center Point Station consisted of a huge sphere 100 kilometers across, with a massive cylinder stuck to each pole of the sphere. The station rotated slowly around the axis defined by the two polar systems.
Boxy things the size of large buildings, pipes and tubes of all sizes, and strange patterns of conical shapes sprouted everywhere.
Luke had been on worlds smaller than this station. Apart from the question of size, the station was disconcerting because it spun. Spinning was something that planets did, but you could see Center Point moving. Something else, more fundamental than size or spin, was bothering Luke. The station was so old that no one knew how long ago it had been built, or who had built it, or why.
Oh, you're there.
I'm here, Lando, but your signal is breaking up badly. With normal communications still jammed, the Bakurans had done their best to improvise a laser comm system that sent voice signals over low-power laser beams. It did not work well, but it did work. R2, see if you can clean that up a little. Luke nodded. Okay, Lando, try it again. How do you read me?
Much better. Thanks. Galanda spotted something. Look at the base of the closest cylinder. Right where it joins the sphere, there's a blinking light. Here, see it?
Luke activated the targeting computer to get a lock on the blinking light. There it was, next to a large outer airlock door that was opening and shutting over and over again. If that's not an invitation to come on in, I don't know what is. Anakin Solo stared at the featureless silver wall, and then thumped twice at one particular spot on it. Sure enough, an access door popped open, revealing a purple and green control keypad with a grid of keys. The 7-year-old frowned at the keypad, as if trying to decide his next move. The droid Q9X2 watched carefully. Q9 found Anakin's skill with machinery, his seemingly instinctive ability to make devices work even when he had no idea what the devices were, to be remarkably disconcerting. It seemed to have something to do with this force business that was so important to this group of humans. The theory seemed to be that Anakin's talent in the force had given him the ability to see inside machines. Not that the little boy was infallible by any means. Anakin punched a code into the access panel. Experience had taught Q9 that this sound was not a good sign. It seemed to be a sort of warning bell.
That will do, Anakin.
But I've almost got it working.
Do you have any idea what it does?
No, Anakin admitted.
Do you remember what happened the last time you heard that chime and you kept going?
A trap door opened.
Yes, a trap door opened under me, and I fell into a waste disposal chute.
Oh, maybe I better stop and let Chewie look.
Maybe you'd better. Come on. Let's go find the others.
They were a motley crew, all of them holed up inside the underground repulsor chamber on the planet Drawl. The place was shielded from every detection system that Q9 knew about, with the exception of Anakin Solo. Anakin had found this chamber and its identical twin on Corellia with no trouble whatsoever. And there were good reasons for hiding the chamber. It contained the planetary repulsor that had propelled Drawl into its current orbit unknown millennia ago. Likewise with Corellia, and no doubt with the other inhabited worlds of the Corellian sector, Celonia and the double worlds Talus and Trollus. Each of them had a hidden chamber like this one. The party in the repulsor chamber had been cut off from outside contact for some time, but the last information they had was that rebel forces on at least some and probably all of the inhabited worlds were actively searching for the repulsors, possibly so they could use them as weapons. The chamber itself was a huge vertical cone made of gleaming metallic silver. At the base of the chamber was a circle of 6 smaller cones of the same silver material. In the exact center of the base was a 7th, larger cone,
twice as tall as the others, but with the same slender proportions. Passages to side chambers were spaced around the circumference of the chamber, and vertical shafts in the floor led to a series of lower levels they hadn't even started to explore. It was a huge, artificial, alien place. And a ramshackle, homey-looking campsite was sitting right in the middle of it, by the base of the central cone. The Millennium Falcon was also in the chamber, the hover car belonging to the Solo children's Drolin tutor Ebrahim, and his aunt, the Duchess Marcha of Mastagophorus, was parked alongside it. A line with washing on it was strung between the Falcon's topside parabolic antenna and a spike antenna on the roof of the hover car. Q-9 could see the rest of the party from here. The twins, Jason and Jaina, carrying some sort of gear out of the Millennium Falcon, Chewbacca fiddling with hardware, and the two plump, furry drawl at a table hunched over their own work. The drawl were serious, level-headed beings in general. Even if Ebrahim was a bit flighty by drawlish standards, his aunt was one of the most commonsensical beings Q-9 had ever met. No doubt Anakin's latest discovery would give them something else to work on, another piece to the puzzle they were struggling to put together. It was well into the night before Ebrahim finally said to the Duchess,
"Come, dearest aunt, it is late. Everyone else is asleep. Whatever progress we have made is only the barest start toward understanding this place,"
the Duchess replied.
"We have some idea of how the keypads are laid out and what some of the button markings and color coding seem to mean. But going from there to operating this place and shutting it down safely, a machine that has been operating for at least tens of thousands of years, we have no idea how it draws its power. Suppose we do learn how to turn it off. Where does the power go once it is not coming here? I think it most probable that this chamber is but one part of a much larger system. We are dealing with a device that can move a planet. Used improperly, a device of that power could also destroy a planet. I do not see any way of learning all we need to know in any reasonable period of time."
"Unless, of course, we simply instruct Anakin to find the main control panel and then set him loose on it."
March's eyes widened in horror.
"Do not say such a thing, nephew. Not even in jest. Jokes like that have a way of coming true."
Anakin's eyes snapped open. He was wide awake and staring up at the underhull of the Millennium Falcon. He sat up quietly and looked around. Everyone was asleep. That left Q-9. Anakin knew that the bulk of the Falcon would block nearly all of the droid's sensors. So long as he kept the ship between himself and Q-9, he ought to be able to sneak away. He moved unerringly through the complicated maze of passages, taking every turn with absolute confidence. And there it was, just as he had left it, the initial keypad open and waiting. He closed his eyes, reached out, and felt the interior of the pad, tracing the circuits, the logic paths, the potentials and safeties that were inside the machine. It had been asleep for so long, waiting for someone to wake it up. Anakin pressed the center button of the grid. The green button turned purple. Good. Slowly he felt each button, pushed them in what he knew was the right order. A section of the floor was sliding away. Then a complicated console rose slowly up out of the floor, all in the same silver stuff as the chamber itself. In front of it was a little seat that looked as if it were intended for a being that bent in different places than a human. Hopping with excitement, Anakin sat down in the odd little chair and did not even notice that it was adapting itself to his body, lifting him up and moving him forward so he would be able to reach the controls more comfortably. He shut his eyes and reached out into the intricate universe of the control panel. Anakin put his hands on the control panel and felt it all flow through him. Somewhere deep below, the ground shuddered slightly, and the hum began to build, accompanied by the noise he'd heard before. A flat spot on the control panel swelled upward to form a handle like a spacecraft's joystick. Anakin reached out to it as the handle reshaped its itself to fit his hand. A graphic display appeared in the air over the handle, a hollow wireframe cube made up of a grid of smaller cubes. Slowly, carefully, he pulled back on the joystick. The cubes began changing color, green to purple to glowing orange. Anakin let go of the joystick. The moment he did, the chiming stopped. The joystick flattened itself back down into the control panel. And there, in the blank space at the center of the panel, a new button appeared. He held his hand poised over the button for a moment. It called to him, or else his own compulsion to make machines work called from deep inside himself. He did not know. He did not care. He reached out his left hand. He held it over the button for a moment. And then he pushed it down. Lightning flared out from the apex of the central cone in the great chamber, lancing out toward each of the lower cones, slamming into them with spark and fire. Thunder, the sound of the earth cracking open, roared out through the great chamber. The lesser cones answered back, sending their own thunderbolts to strike at the top of the center cone, blasting it into incandescence. Chewbacca, aboard the Falcon, was thrown from his bunk as the ship bounced and lurched along with the chamber. He was halfway to the ship's control room before he came fully awake and realized that the ship was not in flight, but where it had been on the ground. He rushed down the ramp and shouted at the Drolls sleeping in the hover car to get aboard the Falcon. He saw Q-9 slump next to his charging stand, completely motionless. He scooped the droid up and headed for the Falcon. At that moment, the lightning struck again, blasting out from the central cone to the six smaller cones. The Falcon bounced on its landing jacks, riding their shock absorbers. The two Drow, the droid, the twins were all on board. Chewbacca suddenly realized that Anakin wasn't on the ship. He turned and headed toward the door. "Anakin's safe!" Jason shouted over the din, clearly seeing Chewbacca's concern. "He's in some side tunnel. I can feel him through the Force. He's not hurt, and he's more scared we'll be mad at him than scared he'll get hurt. I think he set this off." Chewbacca rushed for the cockpit and activated the Falcon's shields at full strength. The Falcon rose up off her landing jacks to rest on a cushion of softened lower side shields. The bucking and heaving of the deck was still felt, but the shield smoothed it down. Another spectacular cycle of lightning bursts flashed between the cones, and then another, and another, each growing faster and more powerful. Suddenly, the entire ship was bathed in a firestorm of sparks and flares that coursed around the shields, then swooped up the sides of the conical wall toward the apex of the chamber. Chewbacca began to realize what was happening. The chamber of the planetary repulsor was opening out its apex point to get a clear shot at the sky. There had been a whole series of underground tunnels leading to the hidden entrance to this place. Surely, all of them had collapsed. Along with the Drawlist building that sat atop them, the Drawlists had been searching for the planetary repulsor. By now, the planetary repulsor had found and destroyed them. Jason came into the cockpit.
"They're all okay back there," he said. "Except Q-9. He's still dead. Or off, anyway."
Chewbacca nodded. They were lucky any of them were alive. If Q-9 could be repaired, he would attend to it later. If not, well, one casualty seemed a very low price for riding out this storm. Another pulse of energy swept over the Falcon. A bit rougher ride than the last one. That was a reminder, Chewie thought. A reminder that they weren't close enough to the end of this to talk about living through it. Thrakken Sal Solo, self-proclaimed diktat of the Corellian sector, leader of the Human League, stared at the bottle in front of him and gave serious thought to the idea of getting good and drunk. There seemed precious little else he could do besides wait. Thrakken had never been much good at waiting. Which was ironic, for he had spent much of his adult life waiting for a superior to resign or retire or be arrested, waiting for a plot to mature, waiting for the long-awaited offer of succession from Dupas Tomri, diktat of Corellia, waiting until the day Tomri died, waiting for sweet victories that had melted away into bitter, humiliating defeat. Thrakken grabbed the bottle by the neck and went out into the corridor of the archaeological dig headquarters.
He would have preferred to keep his headquarters in the underground bunker on the far side of the city, but the Human League had been forced to abandon that location. The blasted Salonians had yanked their compatriot Drachmas out of there, along with Thraken's traitor cousin, Han Solo. It hadn't taken much imagination to realize that a group that could take two prisoners out of an underground bunker could just as easily put one bomb in. Call it another debt on the account Thraken was drawing up against Han Solo. Outside, Thraken watched the second shift men coming on duty, headed for their work underground. They were still searching for the Corellian planetary repulsor. It had to be hidden in the tunnels somewhere beneath them. It had to be, or things were going to get very sticky indeed. Except things were already sticky. Solo had escaped. Leia Organa Solo had escaped. The Bakurans had busted through the interdiction field somehow. Thraken knew just how dangerous a game he was playing. He had claimed to control the Starbuster plot, the power that had already exploded two star systems, one of them populated. For the moment, at least, it suited the purposes of the Starbuster's real masters to let him go on claiming it. They believed Thraken would keep to his side of the bargain and back off his claim when the moment came for them to reveal themselves. They also believed that Thraken would turn over the planetary repulsor on this world as soon as he found it in return for getting a free hand on Corellia. Thraken had other plans. The masters of the Starbuster had told all the rebel leaders that the planetary repulsors were superb defensive weapons, nothing more. Thraken knew better.
Diktat Sal Solo. Diktat.
Thraken turned around to see General Bryman Yorar, the man in charge of the dig, jogging toward him.
News, sir. Maybe big news. The Drawl planetary repulsor just came alive.
What?
Just now, sir. The jamming is still in place, of course, so we can't get any more information. But our sensors just picked up a huge jolt of repulsor activity coming from Drawl. Unfocused, uncontrolled, but it's there.
I don't believe it. I can't believe it. The Salonians, maybe they're good at underground work. The Overden has some good technicians, but the Drawlists, they were never anything. In moments of honesty, Thraken knew his own Human League forces were not exactly the cream of society. Thugs, most of them. Even with all the help he got from the Starbuster's masters, he had not been able to recruit many high-quality people. He had learned to accept that and view his troops as the best tools he could lay his hands on, if not the best tools for the job. But thugs or not, compared to the Drawlists, the Human Leaguers were perfect gentlemen and leading scientists, every one of them. Thraken had at least been able to buy himself a few disgruntled technicians, some ex-Imperial soldiers and administrators, not the Drawlists. Whatever else you could say against the Drawlish species, the pompous little fools were, for the most part, relentlessly honest, upright, cautious people. There had actually been some sort of discontent on Corellia, and probably on Salonia and Talus and Trollis, around which to build a revolt. On Drawl, the rebellion had been, out of necessity, completely artificial. Even the Human League wouldn't have taken on humans as low down as the Drawlists. And Drawlist technical capability was no better than Drawlist behavior. Wait a minute, Thraken thought. Wait just a moment. Maybe the Drawlists hadn't gotten it running. Maybe someone else had managed that little trick. Suddenly, he had a shrewd idea who that might be. He turned toward Yarar. Get the best of the repulsor tech crews together along with a strike platoon. He lifted the bottle to his lips and took a big swallow.
We're going to pay a little call on the Drawlists.
Luke watched the blinking light over the huge airlock chamber and wondered who was on the other side asking them in. He shut his eyes and reached out, probing with his force ability, searching for the feel of the station of the beings aboard it. He could detect exactly one sentient mind, a human one, a young woman. That mind seemed worried and afraid, but friendly enough for all of that. The deck of the airlock was littered with debris, bits of clothing, broken pieces of luggage, freight containers, abandoned machinery, even a small spacecraft with all its access ports opened and its nose assembly removed. Obviously, it had been cannibalized for parts. The comm was activated.
Looks like some folks got out of here and hurry.
Looks like, Luke answered Lando. But what exactly had they been in such a hurry to get away from? Luke made a nice, smooth landing, and the Lady Luck eased down on her repulsors in front of the X-Wing. The moment she landed, there was a shimmering in the space over their heads. Then the activated force field settled down into a thin blue haze that surrounded the two ships. Luke understood that by using a force field system, the station's controllers could avoid constantly pressurizing and depressurizing the chamber. No small issue with one this size. A tunnel, formed of the same blue haze, came into being just behind the Lady Luck. Luke could see that it led to a more conventional-sized inner airlock hatch. The incoming air whipped up some of the debris until the inside of the force field bubble was swirling with bits of paper and dust and torn-up packing material. The X-Wing rocked back on its shock absorbers as the air pushed at it. Luke watched his exterior gauges as the roaring subsided. At least as far as his instruments were concerned, it was perfectly normal air at perfectly normal pressure. He popped the canopy of the X-Wing and dropped lightly to the ground. As the others emerged from the Lady Luck, Luke heard a beeping from the topside of his X-Wing. Don't worry, R2, I haven't forgotten you. He reached out with the force and lifted R2 into the air and was just about to bring him down to the deck when the hatch at the end of the force field tunnel began to lumber open. Everyone turned to look. A tall, thin, pale-skinned woman with prominent eyebrows came in. She hesitated at the entrance for a moment, and then shrugged and walked toward them at a brisk clip. "How are you doing that?" she asked. "And why?" "Huh?" Luke asked and looked up. "Oh!" He had nearly forgotten that R2 was still hanging in midair. If he had lost any more concentration, R2 would have crashed to the deck. He landed him gently. "It's sort of a long story," Luke said. "I'll bet," the young woman said, giving Luke a quizzical look. "Well, anyway, I'm Jenica Sonson, C-Point C-00 ad op." "What?" Luke asked. Sonson sighed. "Sorry, force of habit. Centerpoint Chief Operations Officer, Administration and Operations. Basically, I run the place these days. The C-Point CE declared a bug out right after the first major flare incident, and the whole exec-sec evac'd along with practically all the C-Point civ-pop. I wish I could get out of here, but I was OOD when the bug was called, so Reg said I was stay behind." Luke was about to ask her what that meant when 3PO stepped forward.
Perhaps I might be of help, Master Skywalker. I believe that what Administrative Officer Sonson means is that Centerpoint's chief executive ordered a full evacuation after the first flare disaster, and the entire executive secretariat left along with most of the civilian populace. Although she wished to leave with everyone else, Administrative Officer Sonson happened to be the officer on duty at the moment when the evacuation was declared, and under those circumstances she was automatically designated the officer to stay behind and serve as a caretaker."
"She didn't say anything about a disaster," Lando said suspiciously.
"I beg your pardon, but she did refer to a major incident. That is a common bureaucratic euphemism for catastrophe."
"Hold it! The tin box got it all correct, but I am right here. You could ask me what I meant."
"Only if you promise to speak basic like everyone else," Lando said. For a moment it looked as if Sonson were about to bite Lando's head off, but she backed down.
"Oh, maybe you've got a point. But I have to know what you're doing here. Your ships blew out of nowhere, and then those fighters bugged out too."
"Were they your fighters?" Kalinda asked. "And what government do you represent?"
"The fighters you were shooting at?
No, they weren't Fed-Dub."
"Fed-Dub?
Sorry, the Federation of the Double Worlds."
Kalinda nodded. "The Federation is the duly elected government of Talos and Trollis."
"You people still haven't told me who you are and what you're doing here."
"Our apologies," Gariel said, speaking for the first time. She introduced them all. "We are taking possession of Centerpoint Station in the name of the New Republic."
"Well, good. It's about time somebody did. Come this way and I'll show you where everything is." She turned around abruptly and started walking down the tunnel. On the opposite side of the lock chamber, they entered a waiting turbovator car. "We might as well start out with Hollowtown. It's what everyone always wants to see first."
"Hollowtown?"
Lando asked. There was a second's pause. You're not all that well briefed, are you? Hollowtown is the open space in the exact center of the sphere. Where you docked was just about at the join between the North Pole, that's what the locals call the cylinders, the North and South Poles, and the central sphere. We're now moving parallel to the axis of rotation, sideways, in toward Hollowtown. We have to pass through about 20 kilometers of decks and shells first. A shell is what we call a real high-ceiling deck, anything over about 20 meters or so. There are about 2,000 levels, all told.
What were the flares you mentioned? Luke asked.
You people don't know about the flares?
First we've heard of them. We just broke through the interdiction field into the system a few days ago. Sanson let out a low whistle.
Broke through the interdiction field? That's something, all right. I'll bet whoever's creating that field isn't real happy with you just now.
Kalinda frowned. Hold it. Centerpoint Station is generating the interdiction field, and the communications jamming, for that matter. You didn't know that?
Nope, none of us here did.
Looks like my briefing wasn't so good either.
What you've got to understand about this place is that no one understands it, Sanson went on. We just live here. We didn't know why Centerpoint did most of the things it did, but we knew what most of them were, or at least we thought we knew. Up until the terrorists started showing us a few tricks.
Oh, we just got here, Lando said. What terrorists?
Sanson shrugged her shoulders.
No group has claimed responsibility. We have suspects, the Trata Libbers, the Two Worlders, and so on, but they all denied having anything to do with it.
Luke guessed that the Trata Libbers meant the Trollis and Talis Liberation Party or some such. Two Worlders probably meant some crowd that wanted separate governments for each planet. Tell us about the attacks.
Sanson went to the Turbovator car's viewport.
You'll be able to see for yourself in a minute or two. Hollowtown used to be quite a place. It grew enough food for the whole station. It had parks and nice homes and lakes and streams. Then someone started messing with the glow point.
The glow point being a sort of artificial sun, Luke asked.
That's right, and someone made it go crazy.
Who normally controls the glow point? Lando asked. How does it work?
One theory is that it draws its power directly from the gravitational interflux between Talis and Trollis, but no one has been able to come up with an instrument to test the idea.
A spot of light began to gleam through the end of the tunnel up ahead.
That's the glow point. It's back to normal, at least for the moment.
The humans in the group shielded their eyes against the sudden brightness.
The glow point was just that, a glowing point of light suspended in midair in the precise center of the huge spherical chamber that was Hollowtown. It looked like a miniature sun, warm, comfortable, inviting. But there was nothing comfortable about the landscape below. Hollowtown had been charred to a land of ashes. Luke could see the skeletal remains of burned-out buildings, what had once been neatly planted orchards that were now nothing but rows of incinerated tree stumps. A lake had boiled dry. Normally I'd stop the car at one of the intermediate stops and let you get out and look around, but there's just about no free oxygen left in there. All of it got consumed in the first flare, 30 or 40 days ago.
Kalinda objected. That was before the jamming started.
I came into the system about that time, and I never heard anything about this. It should have been big news. Now, we tried to keep it as quiet as we could. The Fed-dub government was weak enough as it was. And what terrorists want most is publicity. The Feds were afraid that if this got out, it could spark a panic or even a rebellion here. And I guess they were right. We could have kept news of this from getting to the other worlds, but the refugees all had to go to Talis and Trollis.
The word spread, and we got our rebellions all right, one on Talis, two on Trollis. One group, I don't know which, landed a bunch of fighters somewhere on the South Pole a while back, claimed the station for themselves. What was I going to do, fight them off by myself? I left them alone, and they did the same to me, until you chased them off.
What do you mean, by yourself? Gariel asked. Are you the only one still on the station?
Sanson shook her head.
Probably not. It's a big place. I haven't seen anybody, but that doesn't mean anything.
You referred to the first flare, Lando asked. How many were there?
Two in all.
The second happened just about a day or so before the interdiction field and the communications jamming came on. Lando said a bit distractedly,
"This station is exactly at the center point, the barycenter, between Talus and Trollus, right?"
"Right."
"And the glow point is at the exact center of Hollowtown? And Hollowtown is at the exact center of the station?"
"It might be off by a centimeter or two. Feel free to get a measuring stick."
Lando ignored Sanson's sarcasm.